From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The word from the White House is clear. Saddam Hussein is a bad, bad man, an evil man. And one way or another, he's got to go. But U.S. attitudes toward the Iraqi dictator were not always so cut and dry. Just two decades ago, the U.S. was supporting Hussein with intelligence, financial aid, and war plans. How Saddam morphed from partner to villain just might be a cautionary tale for today. This hour, On Point, the tangled history of Uncle Sam and Saddam Hussein. On Sunday, Bahrain, a key U.S. ally, and Iran issued a joint statement opposing unilateral military action against Iraq. The island of Bahrain is home base for the U.S. Navy's Fifth Fleet and has been a key center for operations in Afghanistan. Joshua Marshall is a frequent contributor to the Washington Monthly and author of an article in the June issue, Bomb Saddam. I asked him to assess the significance of Bahrain's opposition to war with Iraq.
Bahrain is a very close U.S. ally. It obviously says a lot that they are not only coming out in opposition to this, but they're doing it in concert with Iran, with all the implications that that has. Having said that, though, these statements are becoming fairly perfunctory from all of our allies in the region, and I don't think people believe that we're not going to be able to use those port facilities pretty much no matter what we do. So it's important in a general sense that clearly none of our friends in the region are willing to come out and say they support this. It's also easy to overstate how important it is.
So you don't see the U.S. Navy not having access to the Bahrain base it has used so extensively in Afghanistan. Nevertheless, this is a very different picture than the 30-nation coalition that went into the Gulf War on Iraq.
Very different. It is clear we really have basically no one on our side in this. The administration will say that the countries in the region have to make these statements for public consumption, but they'll be with us in some passive way or something like that when push comes to shove. I think most people think that especially the smaller Gulf emirates like Bahrain or Qatar or stuff like that, if we push hard enough, they will allow us to use their facilities and stuff like that. But the overall picture is clear. No one is supporting us in this, and I think that's impossible to deny.
Does that have an operational consequence for the U.S. military when and if it's ready to go to war with Iraq?
I think from everybody who I talk to in uniform and on the civilian side, it does not make it impossible. There's Saudi Arabia that takes up most of the Arabian Peninsula, but then there are also these emirates along the Persian Gulf, mm-hmm. and we have facilities there, and I think most people believe that with those, which we almost certainly will have access to, that it is doable. But it's much harder than if we had the full use of the facilities and the ground and the airspace in Saudi Arabia and so forth. So doable, but much harder.
And what is the significance of Iran showing up in so many of these statements? The king of Bahrain was visiting Iran. He was talking with Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, who said that dialogue and closer relations between Iran and its Arab neighbors would help stop American threats. The Iranian leader said the U.S. president openly speaks of a crusade war. Under such circumstances, Muslims should get together and closer and increase their cooperation. First visit by the king of Bahrain since the Islamic Revolution in Iran. How important is this, and what does it mean that Saudis are talking with the Iranians now, Bahrain's king is talking with the Iranians and others?
One thing it shows, you know, when the administration came in, they had this line that they would apply leadership and our allies would sort of gather around us and so forth. That's clearly not happening, and there's just no getting around the problem it represents for U.S. diplomacy and U.S. interests that our very close allies are getting closer to Iran. Iran has its own unique interests here. On the one hand, Iraq is a long-term adversary of Iran. There's no love lost there. Obviously, mm-hmm. the Iranians don't want to have us be such an overwhelming power in the region. And in some ways, having Saddam in his current state is a good situation for Iran. He's not a threat to them. He's very weakened militarily. He kind of keeps us pinned down in an awkward kind of way. The Iranians here are playing their own unique interests and obviously right now at least gaining ground with other countries in the region at our expense.
One would think that Iran, with its history of terrible war with Iraq, would be highly attuned to what Washington calls Iraq's development of weapons of mass destruction. If they're not, why not?
I suspect that they are. I have no doubt that they are. I think they are very concerned about WMD in Iraq. However, again, if you look a few stages down the road here and you imagine an Iraq occupied and reorganized under American tutelage, that's not a great position for them either, and it leaves them really cornered in the region. So I think they have funding interests here, and WMD from Iraq is not the only one.
So if that's Iran's concern, how do you account for the opposition we've now seen from Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, Yemen yesterday, and so many other Middle Eastern countries?
I guess I would put it this way. Supporters of what we seem to be moving towards in Iraq will often make the point that our Arab allies want to see us get rid of Saddam. They just want to make sure it's going to be successful. They just want to make sure we're actually going to follow through. I think that is right to a certain extent, but the analogy would be to an 80-year-old man who has an aortic embolism or something like that, and he's told that if he needs to go through this very risky operation to solve it and his life, if you ask that person, do you want to have this operation? And they say, if you guarantee me that everything is going to go fine, sure, I want it to happen. And that's kind of where these Arab countries are. It is just the idea of us going into Iraq, all the turbulence that will create, all the problems that will create in their own countries is just very, very frightening for them on all sorts of different levels. And at the moment, it's just more frightening for them with all the potential consequences, all the potential fallout, than the near-term risks of from Saddam Hussein.
Joshua Marshall, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Joshua Marshall is editor of Talking Points Memo, a political commentary website, and a frequent contributor to the Washington Monthly. As the Bush administration continues to talk war with Iraq, the litany of Saddam Hussein's sins has become an almost daily White House chorus. But the Iraqi leader was not always locked in America's crosshairs. In the 1980s, Saddam was a partner to the U.S. when the U.S. supported Iraq in the Iran-Iraq War. Just a few years later, the tides had turned. In the Gulf War, the U.S. seriously considered taking out Saddam, but ultimately backed off and left him in power. Tonight on Point, the long and tangled relationship between Uncle Sam and Saddam Hussein. How did the Iraqi leader move from trusted U.S. partner to symbol of all evil? Did U.S. foreign policy itself lay the foundations for today's conflict? Are there important lessons here about unintended consequences of intervention? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us now is Fawaz Jerjiz. He's chair of International Affairs and Middle Eastern Studies at Sarah Lawrence College in New York and author of many books and articles on the Middle East. His forthcoming book is called The Islamists and the West, Ideology versus Pragmatism. Good evening and welcome, Fawaz Jerjiz.
Thank you. Thank you, Jack.
It's good to have you with us. Also with us, yes, speaking of Jack, is Jack Beatty from the studios of Vermont Public Radio, our On Point news analyst. Welcome, Jack.
Hi, Tom, and hi, Fawaz.
Fawaz Jerjiz, take us back into this complicated history of U.S.-Iraq relations. If you put yourself back in the 1980s, when the United States was supporting Saddam Hussein at the time of the Iraq-Iran war, was it possible to foresee then that somehow we were arming a tyrant who would one day come to be called the root of all evil, practically, by the President of the United States?
Well, as you said, it's really a highly complex question. I think what we need to understand is that the Iranian Revolution in the late 1980s represented a major setback for U.S. foreign policy and interest as well. Let's remember that the Shah of Iran was our major policeman in the Gulf, and he maintained stability not just in Iran but throughout the Gulf, particularly when it came to Saudi Arabia, one of the leading countries which has the largest reserves of oil.
So when the Shah fell, the United States was in something like a panic, looking for someone to hold the line against the Islamist revolution.
Absolutely. When America's policeman was exiled, America itself, as we know, came under attack by Ayatollah Khomeini and his revolutionary guards. In fact, as we know, the raison d'etre of the Iranian Revolution itself was anti-American. The Iranian Revolution fed on anti-Americanism. Here, where Saddam Hussein comes in. the United States and Saddam's interests in the late 1970s converged in trying to prevent Khomeini from spreading his message and revolution to neighboring Arab states, including Saudi Arabia and Iraq itself. We do not know yet, of course, if the United States implicitly encouraged Saddam Hussein to invade Iran in 1980s, but the weight of evidence indicates that from the onset, the United States supported Saddam Hussein and provided him with tactical and strategic assistance, which not only enabled him to survive politically and militarily, but also to defeat Iran. Throughout the Iran-Iraq War, which lasted from the 1980s until 1989, and of course, which resulted in almost a million casualties, the United States supplied Iraq with satellite intelligence and, in fact, battle plans, pinpointing the formation of Iranian forces, and of course, America's Western allies, Britain and France, also supplied Iraq with military and technological hardware, which gave the Iraqi army an edge in its war against the Iranians.
I want to ask you, yesterday, front page of the New York Times, lead story, the New York Times is shocked to learn that the U.S. military was aiding Iraq to such an extent, even when it knew that chemical weapons were part of Iraq's battle plan. Is this a shocking new revelation, or is this essentially what we've known all along?
Well, what we knew, that the United States supplied Iraq with satellite intelligence, which really pinpointed the formation of the Iranian forces. What we did not know is the extent of collaboration and cooperation between the American intelligence community and Iraq itself. And while this cooperation and collaboration between the United States and Iraq took place throughout the 1980s, U.S. officials knew that the Iraqi dictator used chemical weapons against the Iranian forces. In fact, U.S. officials were not even bothered with that. It did not seem to be a factor then. In fact, Saddam not only used chemical weapons against Iran in the 1980s, the early 1980s, but also against his own people, as we know, the Kurds, in the late 1990s. With the exception, unfortunately, of a timid response from the State Department, U.S. foreign policy gambled on Saddam Hussein as the man on the horseback who maintained stability in Iraq and, of course, deterred America's enemies, the Ayatollahs. Neither morality nor common sense prevailed in Washington. In fact, real politique was carried to extreme with devastating consequences for all concerned, of course, including Iraq itself, drained and brutalized by its dictator. And, Jack, I'm surprised here. Why were we surprised when Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait in 1990? Actually, Saddam Hussein himself thought that he had a carte blanche from Washington. In fact, the dominant narrative throughout the Arab lands is that somehow Saddam was or is a U.S. crony acting on behalf of the United States. And in fact, what happened in the 1980s and 1990s, unfortunately, deepened anti-Americanism in the Arab world and convinced many Arabs who believe in conspiracy theories that somehow the United States was part of a huge conspiracy, aiding Saddam Hussein to defeat Iran and then, of course, sucking Saddam, and I'm using the word as they use it, sucking Saddam Hussein into the Kuwaiti quagmire in order to defeat and weaken his forces.
Fawaz Jirji, stand by. I want to bring Jack Beattie into this conversation. Jack, as Fawaz Jirji describes it, this was a gamble, and a gamble that did not pay off. It cost the Gulf War and may now be costing yet another war.
Yeah, I mean, the Reagan people defended it at the time on the grounds of, as Fawaz says, a sheer realpolitik, the enemy of my enemy is my friend kind of thing. And we thought the larger danger came from Iran. But what's striking when you look back at this record, and the Times story revived it, is how the United States even violated many of its own maxims in doing this. I mean, for example, there was an arms embargo on Iraq through that war, and yet the Reagan administration consistently worked its way around it, as it did a similar arms embargo in Central America, sending weapons to the Jordanians, which then wound up, as the administration would know, with Saddam and other people, letting exports go on to Iraq of precursor chemicals to chemical warfare, blinking, selling all kinds of $700 million worth of dual-use technology that the Iraqis could immediately turn into weaponry. We just went very, very far to build up this monster.
There was a lot of oil at stake, to say the least. There's a lot of history here. We're looking tonight at U.S.-Iraq history as a backdrop potentially to a new war. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about U.S.-Iraq history, the history of that relationship as backdrop to a potential looming, potential new war. What does America's history with Iraq tell us about how we should move ahead now? Does history suggest more armed intervention is a mistake or that it is required? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been talking tonight with Fawaz Jirjiz, Chair of International Affairs and Middle Eastern Studies at Sarah Lawrence College. We're joined now by Sandra Mackey. She's author of several books on the Middle East and most recently, The Reckoning, Iraq and the Legacy of Saddam Hussein. Good evening and welcome, Sandra Mackey. Good to have you back.
Thank you.
Sandra Mackey, paint the picture for us, if you would, of the Middle East and Iraq in particular in the late 70s. Maybe that was a kind of, I mean, the oil embargo was already on, but it was a kind of golden era in that we didn't have armed enemies, states in the Middle East. And Iraq was seen as a kind of a great playground for Western business.
Well, Iraq has always had a peculiar relationship with the United States because Iraq, to begin with, is a very unique country in the region. It's an oil-rich country, but it's a very fragile country as far as its political structure is concerned.
That is Kurds in the north, Shia Muslims in the south, and a Sunni minority holding power in the center, Baghdad.
That's correct. And the United States has never really looked at Iraq as, a tormented country with very specific problems. We've always dealt with Iraq as simply an extension of another problem. And certainly during the 60s, we saw Iraq principally in terms of its flirtation with the Soviet Union. And everything relating to Iraq really was in the context of the Cold War.
And then later in the context of Islamic Revolution in Iran. But is it fair to say that the U.S. is reaping a whirlwind of its own creation here, or is Saddam Hussein a kind of wild card factor that no one could have predicted?
Well, you know, like so many things, I think, you know, it's a combination.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, the United States during the 1980s was so, I would say almost on the verge of hysteria about the Islamic Revolution in Iran. And we really saw that as the only threat to the United States. And, we never really understood that revolution. And, of course, we looked at it in terms of the hostage crisis, which was, of course, a very emotional issue for the United States.
Huge trauma.
It was. And I think we could say the same thing about the Cold War, that we really felt, you know, very threatened by the Cold War. And, you know, that led us to do some things that maybe were not, you know, in our long-term best interest. But Saddam Hussein really has come up partly as a result of the nature of Iraqi society and their very turbulent political history. And I think that, in a sense, he has been underestimated all along by the fact that, you know, he was considered early on as a street tough, as someone who really didn't know anything about the outside world, which was certainly true, and I think to a large extent continues to be true. And
took power in 1979 in a
yes.
night of long knives, and now has fairly complete power in Iraq.
Well, now that's what we're not quite sure about.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's one of the arguments about maybe jumping into this war against Iraq is, keep Saddam Hussein contained and keep a close eye on him, but see what happens, because he is not, you know, that secure in his power base in Iraq. I mean, he controls the country through two factors. One is just, you know, a secret police and sheer terror. But the other is this alliance he has with tribal leaders. And you really get outside of the center of Iraq, Baghdad, Tikrit,
and his hometown.
You start going particularly north, but also south, and his power really depends on these alliances with tribal leaders. And these tribal leaders have always been people who have been very suspicious of Baghdad's power, and they will strain against Baghdad at any time they don't feel their interests are being met.
And could conceivably do that even in the months or year ahead. Jack Beatty, do you have a sense that Americans have the whole story when they are tutored by the White House about Iraq and the reasons for war?
No, I don't. I mean, I think that that there's been a kind of compensatory demonization of him, not to say that he isn't as bad as everybody says, but isn't it interesting that after he used gas on the Kurds in the late 80s, the Senate, the House voted to restrict trade with him, a trade embargo, and the Reagan and then Bush administration strenuously worked against that. Same evil, same man, they worked against it. He became evil when he crossed the line in Kuwait. Well, of course, that was a long-standing border dispute. Others know much more about it than I do, between these two countries. And he had no right to invade Kuwait. But suddenly he passed, you know, suddenly the whole premise of U.S. policy through the Reagan and Bush years was thrown into complete failure. It had failed. They had gambled on the wrong horse. And how did they react? By demonizing the horse. By suddenly night was day. I mean, 3 days before the invasion of Kuwait, a Pennsylvania company was sending the materials for making cannons to him with the support of the Bush State Department. 3 weeks before that, our ambassador, April Gillespie, was giving a craven interview with him in which she said, oh, you know, the press in America really gets you wrong, and we want to have good relations with you, and on and on and on. And then 3 weeks later, he becomes the devil. Well, I think what was really going on there is they don't want us to look at the mess that Reagan and Bush Sr. helped to create in the Middle East.
Listeners, if the U.S. helped make Saddam, is it Washington's job now to deal with the problem by war if necessary? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Fawaz Jirjes, are you prepared to draw those kinds of lines of U.S. responsibility about Saddam's rise and his ambitions? Is there something that's been fundamentally out of whack in the U.S. approach here, or is this just the exigencies of foreign policy and dealing with a resource like oil, and this is just how it unfolded?
Well, Tom, I think what Jack has just said is highly critical here. No one is suggesting somehow that Saddam Hussein is a creation of American foreign policy, that Saddam Hussein is himself a product of his domestic and regional environment. But truly, one cannot dismiss and cannot neglect what American foreign policy has done in the last 25 years. And I think I thank you very much for putting this question on the table, because I think the American audience, our fellow citizens, should know that somehow this man finally or suddenly turned to be an evil man. I think the question is, we need to ask ourselves, what is the moral responsibility of the American foreign policy? Why has the American foreign policy establishment went to bed with this bloody dictator? What is our moral responsibility in this? Don't actions have consequences? And the consequences have been with us since, I suppose, the invasion of Kuwait. And even here, let me add just one footnote. Even after Saddam Hussein was defeated in 1991, after he invaded Kuwait, I think the dominant narrative in the Bush administration, the senior Bush administration, was that Saddam Hussein was a safer gambler or gamble than any potential new leadership. In fact, the administration decided to maintain or keep Saddam Hussein in power because Saddam Hussein was capable of keeping Iraq intact and preserving stability inside Iraq itself.
This is after the Gulf War. This is why you're saying the troops didn't go on to Baghdad. Is even after that invasion of Kuwait, he was better than the alternative, which looked like chaos.
And counterbalancing, of course, Iran being a major regional power, since, as we know, that a majority of Iraqis are Shiites, and Iran is the major Shiite country in the region. So even after he invaded Kuwait, even after that terrible blunder, even after we committed 500,000 soldiers to expel Saddam Hussein from Kuwait, the United States was ambivalent about investing, taking risks on new leadership. And in fact, we not only, made terrible blunders, but in fact the Kurds now, realize that they should be much more ambivalent about somehow joining the United States in any major military adventure in Iraq because, of course, we know what happens. You know, they knew exactly what happened in 1991. So while Saddam Hussein is not a creature of Washington's, that the United States and the American foreign policy establishment played a decisive role in empowering Saddam Hussein and making him believe somehow that he can do whatever he wanted. And, of course, that's what he did in 1991 by invading Kuwait.
And when minorities rose up against him after his defeat in Kuwait, the U.S. stood by while they were crushed. Sandra Mackey, is there, in your view, a moral flaw? Has there been a moral flaw in the U.S. approach to Saddam and Iraq, or a strategic flaw? Or were these just steps that had to be taken to protect all that oil in Iraq and right next door in Saudi Arabia?
Well, certainly oil is a, you know, critical issue here. And I wouldn't, you know, discount that or even lessen its importance, downplay its importance. But I think that so much of what was going on was really this fear of what is Iran going to do. And one of the problems the United States has always had in this region is that we have never recognized the Persian Gulf as actually a lake that has an Arab side and a Persian side, and that we really need to deal with that area as a unit rather than what we've always done is play off Iraq against Iran. If Iraq starts getting out of hand, in our estimation, which was what we were seeing in the late 60s and early 70s, then use Iran to balance the power of Iraq. And then when the Islamic Revolution came along, then we used Iraq to balance against Iran. And, you know, we have, when we start talking about what we do about Iraq and how we handle Saddam Hussein, you know, we've got to start saying, you know, what is our policy toward Iran? What are we going to do there? Not only what are we going to do in Iraq, and what are we going to do in Saudi Arabia? Because this whole area is so vital, not only to our strategic and economic interests, but to the world economy. And what I see us doing right now is just turning our policy that has been, you know, the core of American vital interest since 1973 of keeping stability in the Persian Gulf, and we're just throwing it to the wind.
But the neoconservatives in Washington would say, maybe so, but look what it's created, and it's time to deal with root causes. Sandra Mackey, stand by. We've got callers who want to join us. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Jay is on the line. Welcome, Jay. You're on the air.
Yes. Good evening, Tom.
Good evening.
It seems to me American foreign policy has no direction, just like many American talk shows. For example, we are talking about the First Amendment, the freedom of speech. When we try to call a talk show and express an opinion, they say, no, that's not what we are talking about. You have to stick with the question.
Jay, are you complaining about my screeners?
No. I'm just kidding. Obviously, the public radio is probably one of the best things there is in America.
Well, it's an open mic for you right now, and give us your question, Jay.
We see exactly the same thing. Give us my question. No comment, please.
Give us your comment.
I'm trying to say, at the time, the American foreign policy was to try to make sure Saddam Hussein will go against Iran because they're trying to stop the revolution. Now, as soon as he stopped it, he thought that he was a mighty god there. Then they turn around against somebody else, Kuwait. Now, as soon as his direction was completely away from the United States, now we're going to demonize him. U.S. foreign policy, unfortunately, has no direction in Middle East because had to do, not independently, always coincide with the Israeli policy. That's why we are in trouble in Middle East.
Well, but that is a direction, and that is a long-time ally. Jay, thank you for your call. Fawaz Yurjay is... Jay says there's no direction to U.S. foreign policy, and he blames the problems on a relationship with Israel. Do you see any merit in that?
Well, I think, Tom, you and Jay have also raised now another critical question. I don't think the question of Saddam Hussein is an isolated question.
Mm-hmm.
I think there is what I call a structural flaw in American foreign policy. If you look at American foreign policy since the mid-1950s, I think American foreign policy has gambled on what I call the man on the horseback, in particular in the Arab and the larger Muslim world. I think American policymakers came to believe that the man on the horseback, and what I am referring to here, the army officers who came to power in most Arab countries since 1950s, they believed that as long as they were pliant, as long as they somehow maintained stability, as long as they were being managed by the United States, well, that was fine. I think, and here the flaw I'm talking about is that the United States took the question of real politique to its extremist sense, and not really paying any attention to the question of the rule of law, the question of the violation of human rights, the question of transparent institutions, and not also realizing that somehow actions have consequences. When we empower a dictator like Saddam Hussein, the consequences are the invasion of Kuwait and, of course, using chemical weapons against the Iranians and his own people. That when we invest in what I call the militant Islamist project in Afghanistan against the Soviets, mm-hmm. that this particular project has consequences. And this leads me to the question of Iraq today. The question on the table is, the possibility or the potential for a military invasion. The question, which we have not really discussed yet, is that somehow, what do we do after we topple Saddam Hussein? Are we sure that the entire country is not going to be somehow torn apart? Are we sure that Iraq will not disintegrate as a result of the major U.S. military campaign? Are we sure that America's allies in the region will not be rocked by this particular earthquake? That the question you're asking, do actions have consequences? Of course they do, because since the mid-1950s, I think we realize that our neglect of the human rights, the rule of law, transparent institutions, of democracy has been very costly. And of course, by the way, taking risks on messy forms of parliamentary forms of government, of course, is very costly and is not, of course, very sure. It's not, we don't know, of course, that whether it works or not. But at least we realize that messy forms of government do not really create the monsters that we have, been dealing with in the larger Middle East in the last 50 years.
But Jack Beatty, we just got 20 seconds before the break, but the Bush administration, at least the neocon end of it, seems to be saying, well, then let's get in there and make room for real democracies.
Yeah, but this is the same crew, and right down to the same personnel, Richard Perle, Paul Wolfowitz, Cheney. This is the same crew, you know, that helped to bet on Saddam in the 80s and early 90s. Their meddling in the region produced what? This invasion of Kuwait, the war. Boy, not a great track record for this bunch.
We're talking tonight about U.S.-Iraq history as a backdrop to a new war. If the U.S. turned a blind eye to Iraq's use of chemical weapons in the 80s, does that bar Washington from complaining now? You can join us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the history of U.S.-Iraq relations as a backdrop to a new war that appears to be looming. What does America's history with Iraq tell us about how we should move ahead now? Does knowing U.S. history in Iraq make our current push toward war more understandable? Does Iraq's history suggest that war on Baghdad will bring order or chaos? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined tonight by Fawaz Yurjay. He's chair of International Affairs and Middle Eastern Studies at Sarah Lawrence College in Bronxville, New York, and by Sandra Mackey, author of The Reckoning, Iraq and the Legacy of Saddam Hussein. You can join us as well, 1-800-423-8255. Sandra Mackey, the one piece that always comes around in these conversations in the diner and the cafe is that there's somehow a Bush family root to this conflict, that there was something with George Bush before the Gulf War that was never quite explicit, that there's now something in George W.'s actions that is a kind of vengeance for his father's not getting into Baghdad for the assassination attempt on his father after the Gulf War. Do you see any merit in this kind of irresistible line of thinking?
Well, it's fascinating. And I think to add to that would be, what's going on this week with Brent Scowcroft coming out and so publicly saying, don't do this. And
number one aide to Bush Sr.?
Yes, very close to George Bush Sr. And, it makes you wonder, is George W. not listening to his father? Does his father have another opinion? Does George Bush Sr. still think that he made the right decision in 91?
Maureen Dowd said on Sunday, what we really need here is family therapy. But of course, that's an easy shot to take. But is there, if you look at the historical record, are there tangled knots in here of Bush family interests, pride, gall that are driving this?
Well, I really don't know. I'm certainly not a trained psychologist, and I don't have personal access to the Bush family. What I would say is that it seems to me that George W. Bush was definitely floundering in the presidency before September 11th, and somehow, he found his issue at that terrible day. And it concerns me that he has become obsessed with, the evil in the world. I have really become very tired of the word evil that is thrown around, on every situation. We use crisis so often, but now it seems to be the code word for any difficult problem is that it is due to evil. And so that's what worries me. And it also worries me that I don't think George W. has either the vision or the intellectual curiosity or the sense of what this region is really like. And I think another question mark of this whole thing is Condoleezza Rice.
She's also spoken very fiercely.
She has, and I think that she deserves a lot of credit for influencing U.S. policy vis-a-vis the Soviet Union when it was collapsing, and I think that was a very successful policy in those, during that transition period. And she came into the White House admitting that she knew nothing about the Middle East, and I have concern that she either is looking at the Middle East through her own lenses, or she really has not, she just doesn't have the gut instinct for the area that...
Sandra Mecki, you yourself have written that sooner or later it will fall to the United States when Saddam Hussein's regime finally tumbles, even if only under its own weight. It will fall to the United States to create order out of what is almost certain to be chaos in that torn country. Maybe this is just the Bush administration, whether George W. or his advisors, taking the bull by the horns.
Well, I think the question is not whether or not the United States gets involved in Iraq. It's really how we get involved. And when you talk about working through a multilateral mechanism where you really have a specific reason for going into Iraq, not just for a regime change, I think that's different than what we're talking about now, where we are, we're playing the man on horseback on the range, going out to bring law and order. And I certainly think the United States is going to have a huge role to play in Iraq when Saddam Hussein falls, however he falls. And one of the things that we just keep talking about over and over again is, well, we're going to invade Iraq and we're going to bring democracy, this code word democracy. Well, even that is very complicated in Iraq because in the beginning, you know, in a post-Saddam government, you probably are not going to be able to go to one man, one vote, simply because the Shia would then have be in the majority position, and the Sunnis are not
just
going,
won't accept it.
Won't accept that. You've got to figure out how the Kurds are going to have an autonomous region, and you've got to figure out how the two areas of the Kurdish region are going to relate to each other. That's one of the things that.
That is the
never,
Turkish and the Iraqi regions.
No, I'm talking about the Talal Jalabani group and the Mossad Barzani group, who are just absolutely bitter rivals with each other.
So divisions within divisions here. Senator Mekki, you lay out the challenge. We'll see how it's handled. I know we've got to let you go. Thank you so much for joining us tonight.
You're welcome.
Senator Mekki is author of The Reckoning, Iraq and the Legacy of Saddam Hussein. Does Iraq's history suggest that war on Baghdad will bring order or chaos? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Jay is on the line. Hi, Jay. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you.
Sure.
One of the things I feel that is the responsibility of the leaders of the country is to frame the debate for us in a public debate. Yet what I seem to feel like is happening from my perspective, and I don't know if maybe I'm unique or not, but is that they're all doing a bunch of backroom thinking and not helping guide our thinking in some way. So we don't really know how to have an informed public debate because we don't really know what they're thinking about, number one. And then number two, there's an issue on the other hand, which is how much do they say without signaling intent that they don't want to signal? How do you have a truly public debate in that arena while they think they're world through? So where do they draw the line between how they lead the discourse for people like me versus how they don't signal what they're doing?
Jay, what about the bumper sticker version of the rationale that's out there almost every day, that there are weapons of mass destruction being developed here, potentially even nuclear weapons, that the United States cannot sit by and let an avowed enemy move forward with those programs to the point that it might threaten the United States? You know, it's kind of a, it is an ahistorical view, but there's a simple logic to it. Do you find it sufficient or persuasive?
Well, I think that may be persuasive to say there's a problem there. I don't know that it necessarily tells me how I deal with it. And when I in my business face a problem, I say, what are my choices A through Z, and what are the trade-offs of all those choices? And that's what the informed public debate wants to be about, yet I don't know how to make those. I don't even know what the choices are, much less how to value them.
Jay, thank you for your call. Fawaz Yirgaz, Jay's observation is one that I'm sure many people feel and share at this point. What's your sense of the missing framework for this debate over whether or not the United States should indeed go to war aggressively with Iraq?
Well, I think the question, let's be blunt about it. No one is suggesting that somehow I or Sandra or Jack or you that somehow would like Saddam Hussein to remain in power. That's not the question at all. I think deep down we all would like Saddam Hussein to disappear, to exit from the scene. And I think the Iraqi people deserve to live. The Iraqi people deserve better. The Iraqi people deserve to be free from the tyranny installed by Saddam Hussein in the last, 20 years. The question, as Sandra put it on the table, is should the United States invade Iraq militarily and try to do what the Iraqi people themselves should do? I mean, this is the question. And what will be the consequences of such a major military campaign? Chaos, as you said, or order? And also on the question of nuclear weapons, Tom, here, it seems to me that the CIA and the consensus within the intelligence community and even our European allies that Saddam Hussein does not have nuclear weapons and is not in the process of developing nuclear weapons. This is, it seems, the consensus. And on the question of
I don't know about that point, Fawaz Yirgaz. I mean, you can read that both ways. Senator Mackey's own book says, quotes a senior Iraqi nuclear scientist who fled the country saying they're just 30 pounds of uranium away from being nuclear armed.
But according to the CIA, Tom, according to CIA, the CIA's conclusion is that Iraq does not have nuclear weapons and will not be able to develop nuclear weapons in the near future. This is the consensus of the CIA. And there's a debate. I mean, it just all reported in the last few weeks. Anyway, that's the question. And even, I mean, the question of chemical weapons, of course Saddam Hussein, has nuclear weapons. The question is, did Saddam Hussein use his chemical weapons against U.S. forces in the 1990s?
I mean, of course he has chemical weapons, and he did not deploy them there, though
Absolutely.
He has deployed them before.
In fact, as your question suggests, Tom, you're asking about the unintended consequences of certain actions. Are we pushing Saddam Hussein by being, determined to really topple his regime and, of course, eliminate all his thugs? Are we pushing Saddam Hussein into the corner and forcing him to use nuclear or chemical weapons against American forces?
But he doesn't look.
Allies?
But he does not look like a man who can be talked out of office. And the Iraqi people have clearly failed to put him out any other way.
And this is really this is the complex question. How do you get to the Saddam Hussein? I mean, since of course Iraqi civil society has been weakened and disintegrated in the last at least 15 years, thanks partly, by the way, to the UN-led sanctions. In fact, again, according to the CIA, the U.S.-imposed sanctions have really, contributed to the strengthening of Saddam Hussein rather than really weakening Saddam Hussein. How do you bring about the exit of Saddam Hussein? Do you do it, internally through an internal, upheaval, or do you do it through a major U.S. campaign? I think it seems to me the consensus, again, in the international community is that and, of course, our European allies on this particular, every single European ally, including Britain, even Blair himself has some major reservations about a U.S. military campaign. The consensus is that a U.S. military campaign will have some major negative consequences, not just on Iraq and the Iraqi people, but also regional repercussions.
And yet we don't quite hear the answer, the path that would satisfy the safety concerns without it. Scott is on the line. Welcome, Scott. You're on the air.
Hi, folks. You all seem to be developing a really nice box to put President Bush in, because you seem to be constructing a scenario where every instance where we might try to do something is the wrong thing to do.
That's the question, isn't it, Scott? What the heck do we do?
Well, I think that President Bush has it right. We're going to have to engage in regime change. We're going to have to do it militarily. I don't think that there's credible internal opposition that would be able to topple him. And we're going to have to go it alone if our European allies, quote unquote, don't agree with us. And to a point to one of your commentators' statements that there's a consensus that Saddam Hussein does not have nuclear weapons. Well, pardon me for not being willing to wager that the consensus is going to be correct. Mm-hmm. If there's a chance that he's close to it, even if it's a negligible one, almost negligible one, I don't particularly want to wait around until he proves it, okay? Mm-hmm. Because there's not just the possibility that Hussein would be using these weapons to lob a missile over to the United States unprovoked. What he would do is use them to deter any intervention in Iraq if he's doing anything else in the region, in that he can threaten nuclear retaliation against Israel, for example, you know, if somebody did try to do something against
Scott, our time is running down, but we've got your point, and I appreciate your call. Jack Beatty, there it is. Scott's expressing a sentiment that doesn't see a way out of a box, doesn't want to see a box built if the threat is there, and sounds to me like the potential basis for public support if and when President Bush does go to war with Iraq.
Well, the Soviet Union had nuclear weapons, and we had a 50-year confrontation with them, and the issue of regime change never arose. Something else was in place, containment, with their vis-a-vis their expansion, and deterrence vis-a-vis their weapons. And I do not see, with all respect to Scott, why containment and deterrence do not work with Saddam Hussein. We know one thing. He wants to stay in office. What earthly motive would he have? Even assuming, of course, he could get his nuclear weapons here. He has, as far as I know, his missiles only go 600 miles at best. What earthly reason would he have to destroy himself, except if we invade and force him to the wall?
Well, we'll see. Fawaz Jirjej, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
My pleasure, Tom.
Fawaz Jirjej is Chair of International Affairs and Middle Eastern Studies at Sarah Lawrence College. His forthcoming book is The Islamists and the West's Ideology versus Pragmatism. And Jack, thanks for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
You can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you.